I'm Sarah Williamson, and this is Going Long with FCLT Global. On this show, you'll learn what it means to be long-term from the top minds in global business and investing. Leaders from companies and investment organizations join us to discuss how they are leading their teams for the long run on issues including capital allocation, risk management, climate change, and sustainability. To learn more, visit our website at fcltglobal.org. Thank you for joining us for today's version of Going Long, the FCLT Global podcast. Our guest today is John Connaughton. He is the global head of Bain Capital Private Equity and co-managing partner of Bain Capital. He has over three decades of experience as a private equity investor. Since joining the firm, John has worked on many prominent healthcare, technology, and media investments. He's also involved in a number of charitable and civic activities, including the Berklee College of Music, Brigham and Women's, the Greenlight Fund, Harvard Business School, the University of Virginia, and more. So, John, welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So let's just jump right into this issue of purpose. Purpose has become an important concept in the business world. We've talked a lot about purpose with companies, and most companies today could tell you what their purpose is, you know, why the world is a better place because they exist, and therefore why they deserve to make a return. Historically, the purpose of the investment industry, whether public or private, has been simply to achieve a return. What do you think of the purpose of the investment industry today, and how have you seen that purpose shift over time?
Well, thanks for that question. I mean, I do think more broadly than the investment industry, I think purpose today is important because I think the role of business, you know, in society is really being attacked. And I think certainly the case of investors being perhaps a destructive force in society is certainly very, very much a narrative that I don't like and certainly needs to be battled against. And so I think this notion of investment and investors thinking about not just the return, but what was the way that return was created? How, you know, how long term was its orientation? What are the unintended consequences of how that return was created? This multiple stakeholder orientation to the return. You're still making great returns, but you have to be a steward of the elements beyond just the financial outcome to really be able to have a purpose and really rally behind people who are attacking you, government, society. You want to basically inspire your employees to know that you're making great returns, but how you make them is also something to be proud of.
And as you think about making great returns, do you think of the goal as some asset owners, for example, think very much about, you know, they're obviously going to pay pension benefits to some beneficiary 20 years in the future. So they think about that as their purpose. They then give their money to you. Other people do the same thing. So what's interesting about the private equity business is you're touching a lot of different pieces. You've got companies where you're controlling, they might have a purpose. You've got clients who or LPs who might have a different purpose. How do you weave yours through that? You try to combine a little bit of all those?
Well, I mean, part of it is I think about what makes us, you know, different in terms of Bain Capital and what our purpose is. You know, we've always been about impact. You know, impact has been the nature of where we started. We were always, you know, value-added investors. We were consultants and operators. We thought we could come up with strategic insights. We could come up with ways to help businesses understand how they could fulfill their potential. And so this notion of building better businesses over the long term by being partners with management teams to achieve that potential, that's certainly been, you know, a critical element of what created our purpose. And then on top of that, we've been hugely engaged in citizenship. I mean, I think it's not been something that, you know, we went out and created a program for. We just did it. I mean, we thought that we were successful and we had to give back to here in the Boston community, to all the different communities that we operate in. So it's been an ethos of employee engagement and volunteerism and giving back philanthropically and putting those together to create, you know, our own purpose as an organization within our communities. And so a few years ago, it was about a decade ago, we sort of put this together. We said, you know, what is really our purpose? And we decided that it had to impact our companies, our communities, the environment, our employees. And so we came up with this overarching statement called a commitment to lasting impact. And that is how we phrase our purpose. And each piece of that is really important. I mean, commitment, it means you have an obligation. You know, this is your duty to do something. You know, lasting, it means long-term. It means sustainable. It means it can't just be transitory. And so when we build better businesses, after we sell them, we want to know that they continue to thrive. And then impact. Impact is clearly the return, you know, that we measure ourselves for, but it's also, are we fulfilling the potential of what we sought to achieve in that company? Are we impacting communities in a positive way? Are we impacting the environment in a way that's sustainable? All of these elements of impact are embodied in that statement.
And I really appreciate the way that you think about those various stakeholders that you're having that impact on. So maybe we could talk about each one of them a little bit. At Bank Capital hire a lot of young people, and they come through here and are excited to work in this place. How do you think about how they respond to that purpose statement and to the impact that you're having broader? Is that one of the reasons that a smart young person would come here instead of, you know, the go across the street?
I hope so. I mean, look, I've been here a long time, so, you know, I'm a bit parochial in my prism that I answer that question. But you know, the truth is, we like to think of ourselves as defying some of these stereotypes that go along with, you know, the investment business. You know, we like to think that we are adding value to companies. We like to think that we're working as teammates to create an insight or to impact our companies. We have a very collegial environment. We like to believe we're invested in the success over long term. Most of our people have been engaged early in their careers, and we've developed them to become, you know, more successful over time. And so this notion of, you know, development, team orientation, impacting companies, having this broader purpose, you know, I think that's always been who we've been as a firm, but I think more and more today, I think it's been a huge part of what people are looking for. I mean, you know, I think we implicitly had that along the way, but now it's explicitly something we need to amplify to attract the talent who don't want to come into this industry because they see those negative stereotypes. They want to be part of something that has that kind of purpose.
And I know this year you put out your first, I think it's ESG report or sustainability report, so trying to sort of encapsulate that in something for your LPs or your investors as well. How much do you think that narrative has changed, whether that is with the employees, as we were talking about, or the LPs? Are they looking for those sorts of things, or are you driving that conversation? Are you pushing them, or are they pushing you? How do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, you know, before we started calling it ESG, mm-hmm. you know, this notion of active governance, employee engagement, we've always had huge high-performance organization focus, and that really involves, you know, going out in all of our companies and really engaging in surveys every year to measure how we're doing. You know, governance, particularly as you got into Asia over the last 15 years, you know, having critical elements of how you're thinking about compliance and governance and good business practices, that's always been, you know, part of what we do. DE&I, we made progress with good intentions and making and measuring it every year, but we didn't have what now we have, which is really intentional programming around our ESG efforts. So the biggest change is basically creating a lot of really good intentions and progress over many decades into a very comprehensive, very integrated process that goes through sourcing, underwriting, diligence, impact in our companies, and then of course everything we do at the firm. So most of what we've done in the last few years, and you referenced this report, is to create that architecture for how we're going to implement it over the next 5 years. And we're beginning in the beginning of that journey in some places, and we're very advanced in others. But I think having a more intentional architecture with goals and measurement and accountability, I think that's where I think the inflection can next happen.
And one of the places you have a huge amount of impact is on the companies that you obviously choose to invest in. So how do you incorporate some of this thinking in the investment process itself? Is it you incorporate that at the beginning, or how do you you mentioned, you know, the governance in Asia, but how would you actually bake these concepts in? Is that separate and put it on top? Do your investment professionals think about these things sort of from day one of due diligence? How does that work?
Yeah, so first of all, I think, you know, this is part of this integration that I've described that we've really undertaken in the last 2 or 3 years. I think we've tried to go back all the way to sourcing, frankly. And some of the investment themes around where we want to invest and where we don't. So there will be things that therefore we won't invest in. So that's sort of one piece early on. And by the way, there's things that are really going to be constructive themes as well around ESG. We have a really interesting specialty paper business called Fedragoni, which has a huge constructive force around ESG initiatives. So there'll be things that are things we don't want to invest in and things we do, and that's in the sourcing side. And then on the diligence and underwriting side, I think we, as part of that process now, will have a screen and diagnostic about where people are with respect to our core commitments on ESG. And not everybody's going to be where we want them to be, and we need to meet them where they are. But we want to use that part of our underwriting to not just think about our operating profit growth and the strategy and how we exit the business, but ultimately what is the place they are in with respect to these commitments, and then what can we do to then over the time, integrating it with our strategic blueprint over the 5 or 6 years we own the business, what can we do if we buy that company to improve those areas? So it is just like our underwriting, it's a diagnostic. And that will be part of how we assess a business more formally in every one of our underwriting and investment committees. And then the hard part really comes to when you get into creating that blueprint after we sign up the company, after we close it, doing the baseline, figuring out therefore what are our priorities going to be, how do we integrate that into governance, how do we integrate that into not just a special committee or, you know, a siloed function, but actually the entire strategic and operating blueprint needs to incorporate that ESG into it. And that's kind of the journey we're on right now. And I think you'll see more and more of that measurement, more and more of that accountability coming back as we get into the full implementation across all of our companies in that area.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that, as a control investor, of course, you have, as well as very being hands-on with the companies, is that ability to take a best practice into, you know, company A, company B, company C, and really have that kind of leveraged impact, if you will, across many companies. So I'm sure you're sort of thinking about how do you bring that in, and then the companies probably sometimes think this is new or different, or maybe sometimes they're, as you said, they've thought about this a lot already. I bet there's a range.
Well, two things there. Well, first of all, I do think this is a huge opportunity for private equity, particularly control private equity. You know, think about what makes our industry great. We're long-term in our orientation. Many of us, certainly we, for 37 years, have been very focused on resources inside the company to create strategic blueprints and then implement them. And we control those companies for a long period of time, so we can be long-term in our orientation. And so from that standpoint, private equity is the perfect place to be the microcosm for testing and then advancing these ideas. Because if you're in a public investor, you can't affect anything. You can try to have all these negative and positive asset selection criteria. You can influence, particularly in your governance, kind of oversight. But at the end of the day, to make it happen, it has to be inside the companies. And so much like everything else inside a company, they have a potential, some of it realized, some of it unrealized. People are at a different place. And so what we try to do is create for each company their own unique way that we think we can impact that company. And it's going to be different by vertical, different by geography, and different about where they are in that journey. But it is going to be bespoke relative to that company. It's one of the hard parts about measurement of all this, because everybody is in a different place. And sectors and verticals are quite a bit different. But I think our industry, if we do this right, can not only perhaps mitigate some of these negative narratives around what we're trying to do as an industry, but actually turn it into a really positive story for private equity. And certainly I think from our standpoint at our firm, we love this idea as creating a new and better narrative for really what we do, combined with really great returns.
And do you think, as you kind of bake in your expectations for a company, do you think you'll actually have a higher exit multiple or something like that if you've got the ESG things right? In other words, is there financial value in getting these things done as well as sort of the softer side?
I mean, there is this false premise, I think, that it's been the constant debate in this area for, you know, decades, I'm sure, and it's certainly palpable today, that this is a trade-off. And there are definitely trade-offs in the short term. And that's one of the complicated things about the short-term orientation of a lot of investor you know, asset classes. But in our long-term vision view of building a great business, to have employee engagement, you know, to think about diversity, equity, and inclusion by having the broadest talent pools, to think about good governance, these are not things that relate to trade-offs. In the environment, certainly there's going to be trade-offs around how do you do things in the long term to create a lower carbon footprint, but over the long term, having a lower carbon footprint, being a business valued that has that positive patina, I think that's really, really positive for an investment return. So at least from our standpoint, these things are quite aligned with building better and great businesses, and given our longer term orientation, we can afford to sort of have that being, you know, reflected in the exit value, not just in the financial return of that particular year or quarter.
Yeah, we have thought a lot about how do you, you know, invest in your supply chain or your employees or all of those sorts of things. And I think the challenge is, as you have said, is that oftentimes in the public markets, if you they can't withstand the J curve, right? But you can, because you've got that time.
Well, and that narrative's changing, right? I mean, I think that even just looking at some of the businesses that we have in our portfolio now that have this constructive track record of creating an ESG footprint, I think, you know, they are being more positively valued by pools of capital that want to put a price tag on that premium to support that kind of business. And so I do think you're going to see this more and more end up in enterprise value.
Yeah, very interesting. You also mentioned your communities and the citizenship, which, as you put it, which is has been a big part of this firm for a long time. So can you talk a little bit about how you have approached and kind of embedded that give back citizenship, whatever you want to call it, in the culture? How do you do that from sort of, you know, top to bottom? And I know in Boston in particular, you and your partners are active in many, many different organizations. So you've obviously made that a priority, and made time for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about a start, and I'm not one of the founders, so I came along 5 or 6 years after people like Josh and Paul and Mark and even Mitt and others, you know, who really had this public service and give back orientation. But you know, after that, you know, people like myself, Jonathan Levine, you know, Steve Bellew, all of us started just continuing to follow in that jet stream of let's really be leaders at giving back and showing example. And so that's the starting point, is the tone from the top and the actions from the top. But then we sort of step back and say, well, you know, we're building a lot of employees, and we're in a community where our example can have a, you know, kind of an amplification effect or an exponential effect by getting the others in the community to also support in the same way. And then in terms of our people, you know, what we tried to do is leverage our resources to give them the opportunity to make an impact through their volunteerism and then board service, even if they didn't have the resources. And so it becomes this positive flywheel where example, resources, engagement, involvement of our people, and then their leadership, and then advancement over time with their resources as they get them, provide the give back. It's sort of been a huge flywheel. And then more recently with our community impact umbrella, we've been able to be much more strategic about how we do that. So how do we engage a city year across multiple cities and engage our companies and engage our employees and engage in those communities that we operate in a much more expansive way than just Boston, which, you know, we were a big part of the city year founding here in Boston. Same thing, I'm involved with Greenlight. You know, they're in 13 cities, soon to be 20 cities. And how do we sort of engage in a much more amplified way, you know, because we do have this huge footprint across not just the U.S., but frankly the globe. So if we can be more strategic about how we use our resources, how we use our footprint, and how we use our employees and our portfolio companies, then I think we can have a much, much bigger impact. So it started out as just the thing to do because that was the right thing to do and in the ethos of the firm, but then it became much more, and it is becoming much more strategic in terms of how we have that exponential impact.
So you think if we, you know, called up one of your more junior employees anywhere in the world, they would understand that this is kind of part of the culture of the place and be thinking about how they were building their own portfolio, if you will, of impact, obviously at work, but also at a charitable organization or something like that.
Yeah, I think so. One of the cool things we did early on, we had this thing called Bain Capital's Children's Charity. Mm-hmm. And we said, for any organization that you're involved with, you can just submit a form for a grant, and we'll, you know, provide a grant that will, you know, hopefully facilitate your involvement and engagement. And that grew into this thing that was $65 million of support for Boston Children's Charities that had huge engagement and involvement with our people. And it was really neat because it was really bottoms up. You know, we didn't really just do these big, big grants. We did even smaller grants so that people could get engaged at the grassroots level through any entry-level position at the firm.
Right. So using time, talent, and treasure, as we say in philanthropy. That's great. Okay. That's terrific. So, you know, one of the things that we've worked on some and worked on with some of your teams as well is, coming back to the DEI issues, is the diversity of portfolio company boards. And so as you know, you have investments in however many companies you have around the world. And historically, the PE-backed portfolio company boards have been small, much smaller than public company boards. They have been more targeted. They've been more hands-on than a public company board, and they've been less diverse. But we've, you know, done work recently together in terms of how to change some of that. Do you think that's working? Are we making progress on that front yet?
Well, I feel like we've made a ton of progress.
Yeah.
And honestly, there were some really important blind spots that I think we had, you know, 4 or 5 years ago that were part of the problem, and frankly, therefore, we were part of the problem, which was we wanted to have it be only our people. And by definition, we're creating our own diversity progress, and we're less diverse than sort of the world of diversity out there. So that was a crutch that disabled our ability to populate boards, is just our using our own people. The second piece was that prior board service was almost a prerequisite for, you know, for being on a board. So by definition, since we're trying to fix board diversity, if you're using prior board service as the prism, you're not gonna get there. So what we decided to do, which I think was a huge unlock, was really focus 100% on capabilities. What is the capability in that specific boardroom that's missing? And then when you start with that premise, and then are much more intentional about finding those capabilities among diverse populations, finding the best people, you're going to find a lot of diverse talent around those capabilities, whether it be tech, you know, HR, you know, global sales, whatever it is, as opposed to, okay, did they sit on our board before? You know, and so that element, I think, was an unlock because it opened a much broader aperture, of course. And the second piece is it allowed for the CEO and that board to really, really bring that person in because they're adding something that is a deficiency that didn't exist on that board. And so I think these two things, I think, you know, led to huge progress. I mean, we've doubled the diverse directors on our board. I think, you know, it's now around 34% in the U.S. Used to be half that. You know, we have 100% of our boards are two diverse board members. And this is all in a period of 18 months. Now, I'm sure you will ask, is, you know, that's only half the battle, because everything in diversity is about inclusion, not just representation. And so we've tried to do work there too. I mean, we've been involved in Directors Academy that tries to prepare board members to be good board members, you know, for diverse talent. Some of that comes into our firm, some of that goes out to the private equity industry. We've been teachers and faculty members inside that program. Onboarding is critical. So you have to have some onboarding that maybe historically we would not have had for all board members. All, by the way, I think it's a good idea for all board members. So this has been an unlock that's had a broader impact. And then you need to have some form of, you know, sponsorship or, you know, a mentorship. But, you know, I think that's also helpful. And so we're sort of on that journey now, too. We think it's working really well. I think the feedback has been terrific from our CEOs. But you got to keep at it. And certainly we need to do more in our international markets where there's much more progress to be made.
And you mentioned pulling from your own pool, which, you know, private equity historically, the investment world broadly hasn't been as diverse as the population. Private equity has been less diverse. What are the sorts of things you're doing to try to change that pipeline, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, well, first it comes back to where we started, which is you know, it's not just diverse talent, but talent has to want to work in our industry, you know. So you have to start with, is this a place that, you know, all talent, diverse talent particularly, who see this industry as potentially even hostile, you know, let alone inclusive, you know, how to make this place a really a place that people feel like they want to make their careers. That's where you start. But then, you know, we had all these great intentions, and we thought we had that place, but we were still only making incremental progress. And so I think over the last couple of years, you know, we've, you know, like a lot of things, it goes from good intentions to intentional programming. And so we've had accountability. We have objectives. It's a five-year target. You know, we want to be 50% diverse in our private equity business, for instance, in the next 5 years. You know, we started at 30. We're at 42. We want to get to 50. We know that representation is not the only thing, so we want to measure inclusivity every year and, you know, do all populations, not just the average, but, you know, the diverse populations feel as inclusive as the non-diverse. And so all of those elements are part of the measurement and accountability. And then on top of that, you know, there needs to be programming that really supports, you know, how to make this successful, whether that be how you look at inclusive leadership training, or how do you look at how you go about your promotion process to include sponsorship, not just mentorship, but people that can advocate for all of our talent, not even just the diverse talent, but advocate for talent, which is a different approach than historically we had done. And there's, you know, how do we create affiliation and affinity among the group? We are a large enterprise. The good news is we have pockets where we have a much larger percentage of diversity, but how do we use the fact that we're so large and the scope of our business to create that sort of I see myself here, the belonging element that I think sometimes is missing as you get started in areas where you're particularly undiverse. So all this comes together in a way that, you know, I would say it's been great, because it's, you know, there has been this top-down focus. People have objectives, but frankly, the sort of the energy at the grassroots level, I think, has been the fun part to see.
Yeah, that's where you get things done. One of the other things we've looked at recently, which is earlier stage, is the use of diverse advisors. The private equity firms, obviously, on average, spend a reasonable amount of money on investment bankers and accountants and lawyers and whatever else. Have you all thought about the diversity of the advisors that you hire as well?
Yeah, consulting firms as well. I mean, mm-hmm. certainly I think that, you know, they're doing the same things. The good news is they understand that that's a business imperative for them. So this is another one of those positive flywheels.
Exactly.
So if we see our you know, teams continuing to show up in a way that doesn't achieve our diverse objectives, that's not going to, you know, we have multiple service providers we can choose.
You can find
from.
Somebody else. That's right.
We can have our cake and eat it too.
That's right. You know. That's right. That should be something that is easier to change in some way. I know we're almost out of time, though. I guess I'd just love to come back to you personally a little bit and this point on philanthropy. And you've talked a lot about how the organization has been supportive of both the Boston community, the children's, and also much more broadly. But can you talk a little bit more about what you and your family like to, why do you support the things that you support? What is it that gets you interested in spending your time, talent, and treasure on a particular activity?
You know, we all have our family histories. You know, I think, you know, my wife's mom was a teacher, my mom was a teacher, my father was a teacher and faculty member. He was a community health physician in the inner city of Baltimore. And so, not surprisingly, and by the way, my parents immigrated from Ireland in 58 and five kids, and we all, you know, were able to go to great colleges because my father made us, you know, focus on that. So, you know, educational access and opportunity and healthcare, you know, particularly with my father's work with mental health and community centers in Baltimore City, I mean, that's, you know, there's no doubt that that's had a huge impact on our priorities, you know, around educational access and opportunity and mental health. And then for my wife, gender equity is also a really big deal. So her own personal, you know, journey and how she saw her own path. So these things are somewhat ingrained in how you develop as humans and as your own personal experience. But beyond that, I think what's been fun is seeing some of these institutions, you know, because we have, you know, our business model minds in the back of our heads. You know, where are these business models that could have this kind of, you know, exponential impact. So I think things like, you know, Greenlight Fund that are trying to leverage some of the best practices around what are the places of successful track record of outcomes. They take a city, look for basic needs, and try to match that with the best philanthropy from all over the country that could come in, and then we can incubate it inside that city to meet a need. And then they try to do that matching and create that network effect across, you know, dozens of cities. I think that kind of thing, you know, City Year was like another good example of that. That really intrigues us because, you know, we can bring our business model orientation to solving some of these issues around educational access and opportunity and mental health and things like that. So I think that really intrigues us, and that really is another big, you know, big driver of what we're doing. Actually, one that we're working on right now, interestingly, right, with University of Virginia is something, they're working on this thing called the Commerce for the Common Good, which has all these similar themes that you're now talking about. Is how do we think about the constructive force of business and society, and so we're working on something with Jim Ryan and University of Virginia on trying to create an initiative around that. Another kind of exponential thing that speaks to these broader themes that we're addressing here today.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Taking this business building for the long term mindset and applying it in the in the social services or charitable areas where you know sometimes those two worlds haven't met as right. much. So that's
yeah, it's amazing how philanthropy, generally speaking, is very fragmented.
It's fragmented.
It's not very scaled relative to the models that can be created to have sustainable outcomes.
Right.
The good news about a lot of our alumni, you know, at Bain Capital, you know, a lot of my former partners, you know, they're off doing that kind of stuff, which is fun for our institution to see.
Great. Well, thank you for your time today. Thank you for your leadership, both on the citizenship side and in the Boston community, but also more broadly in terms of the private equity industry and the shift that is going on. And it's we appreciate your support at FCLT Global and being a thought partner in that. And there's just more and more to come. So
exciting times. Exciting times. Thank you. Thank you for your leadership as well.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Going Long with FCLT Global. Be sure to hit subscribe to get new episodes every other Monday. To learn more, visit our website at fcltglobal.org.